Let's talk. John Brown. I've been looking forward to talking to our next guest for more than a little while. Ahead of the Curve is a book by Graham Leslie. He describes himself as one of life's natural mavericks, a serial entrepreneur and philanthropist who's done rather well for himself. He likes football. I've just seen a picture of him surrounded by guitars. And believe it or not, I've just remembered that he grew up literally, or spent a lot of time, just down the road from here. Graham, good morning to you.
Good morning, Charles. How are you?
I'm very well. And you know, you say then when places and you spring a memory, and then you remember about a specially good meal that you had. Well, you just dropped a name in there, and my mouth is all wet. Is already watering. Just explain what I'm watering on about, please, Graham.
It was round about mid to late 80s, and we were entertaining clients on a sort of twice a year basis down in that wonderful Costa del Sol area. And the place to go at the time was Arnie's Bar. He was an American guy who'd come over, and all he served was ribs. And it was like almost a medieval banquet. It was absolutely glorious. You had a choice of ribs or ribs. And you had a choice of wine that came in a jug. And whatever, you didn't complain because it was embarrassing.
Yeah.
But what a guy he was. Yeah. And it turned out he was a bit of a musician as well. And we ended up playing in a bar on a rooftop in the marina. Two or three nights, we just used to jam and mess around and play. But he was class.
Yeah.
He was absolutely class.
So I mean,
but the ribs, gorgeous.
Yeah, the ribs. No, you as soon as you said Arnie's ribs, and I remember going down there as a George Michael hairstyle wearing sort of like teenager. It was the '80s. It was the '80s straight line. What do you expect? You describe yourself as a maverick, and it's quite interesting because one of your success stories has been in the pharmaceutical industry, but with the greatest respect to other people in the pharmaceutical industry, they tend to be sort of a bit more staid. I mean, you don't get an awful lot of mavericks, or am I completely thinking up the wrong tree, Graham? How did you sort of start out?
Basically, I moved to Huddersfield. I was unemployed, and I was going for every job in Yorkshire, you can imagine, because you've got two children and a mortgage. And the 31st job I applied for was with a pharmaceutical company called Winthrop Pharmaceuticals, and interviewed at the post house in York. And the gentleman there, would you believe, decided, he later told me, in the first 30 seconds of the interview that he wanted me.
Right.
Now, the difference was, huge difference. In those days, they used to employ pharmacists, doctors that wanted to go into sales and marketing and so forth. So I was the first, so we say, brain dead non-academic that they took a risk with. Because when I went on the training course, when they appointed me, I discovered I was dyslexic.
Oh, blimey.
And what a time to discover you're dyslexic. So that was a bit of a shock. So I handed in my resignation and said to this guy, Tony Hope, and my boss, who's still alive, he was at the book launch last Friday, Dennis Corson, wonderful, wonderful man. They said, listen, we'll get you through it. So I said, you're going to have to teach me how to spell. I couldn't even pronounce the formulas in the drugs. So that was the first bit of, so we say, them being buccaneerish.
I mean, do you think that's part? I mean, I don't want to get all go psychiatrist couch on you here, but I mean, because I'm a big motor racing fan, and Jackie Stewart was famously dyslexic, and he kept it from people for years, but he reckoned that drove him on, that gave him greater ambition. I mean, do you think that helped? Do you think that drove you, or was it just you were a natural maverick and you just thought, well, you know, I can get this far, so I might as well go for it?
I think it was a combination. First of all, in the school in Middlesbrough, where I was brought up, you were punished if you didn't read, if you couldn't spell. You were caned. And it was just the society and the environment then. So I think I was determined to overcome it. And I spent and still do, spend a lot of time motivating youngsters at school, people at work who are just discovering it, and explaining to them that it's, you know, it's not a disease, it's not a failing, because you actually end up, I mean, what I learned was able to ad lib. I don't do any rehearsal. I just do everything off the cuff, because if I've got to read a script, I'm buggered completely. Yeah. I failed miserably. So it just comes out, you know. So it's a bit like some other sense in your body and mind actually takes over.
Yeah.
You compensate, you know, like you limp. If you've got a bruise or a bad hip, or so, you limp and the other one gets stronger. It's just the same with dyslexia. Absolutely the same. You just convince them that they don't have a problem and say, okay, what are you good at? And build on that.
It's interesting, so, yeah, it's interesting when you talk to kids, isn't it? Because a lot of people spend a lot of time, especially now, oh, they're millennials, they don't do anything, and they kind of write them off. And my old school asked me to do the speech a couple of years ago, or last year, and I just said, yeah, you know, I'm in awe of you lot, because you've all been through so much, and you get such a hard time on social media, but you've all got to get a talent. You've all got a talent in there somewhere, and it's just bringing it out.
It is, yeah, totally. Totally believe it is fascinating. I mean, that's what builds teams. That's what we're watching now at the Olympics. You know, in the teams yesterday, it was an amazing day for Great Britain. And it's all about the teamwork. They all have the strengths. And I always say, if one and one just makes two, then don't do it. If it makes 11, great.
So
that's what it's about.
So how did you take the company that you had joined, and they'd taken a chance? How did you take it from a successful company to one that, was it 86 million was sold for? How did you, I mean, I don't need to take the trade secrets, but what was it that you, did you change the culture? Did you just galvanate people? Had they never seen anything like you before in the pharmaceutical industry?
They'd never seen anything like the culture, because the business plan, when I was working at Winthrop, I took it to my employees, obviously, and they just laughed and said, there's no way that's going to work. We're not interested. We're big brands. We sell prescription drugs. We sell pharmaceutical drugs. And I was wanting to get the drugs and the costs and everything to the people, to get them into every outlet within the UK and Europe, you know, on the corner shop. So that was the Maverick buccaneering approach, which obviously upset the hierarchy in the pharmaceutical industry, as you can imagine. But ironically, I ended up years later with Cameron on the All-Party Health Select Committee. So how ironic is that, having reinvented the NHS and, you know, still save them over 500 million a year because of the culture of what we did. It was, you know, switching molecules from prescription to pharmacy and from pharmacy to grocery. We switched ibuprofen in 1995 in the UK. Having trialed for nearly 3 years all the documentation of proving how effective and efficacious it is. Mm. So why not let the public be able to buy it and reduce the queues and the waiting queues in doctors' surgeries, et cetera, et cetera. So we took it. Sorry, yeah.
No, it's all right. Sorry, please continue.
Yeah. So we took it, you know, the first available ibuprofen into grocery. And so you could buy it in Sainsbury's, Tesco, Asda, supermarkets, corner shops. Unfortunately, it worked. So just believe in your own, you know, if you've done the maths, you've done the research, you've done the read all the data. I've been in the industry for 9 or 10 years. And if you cannot conform, which is something I have big difficulties in doing, you can imagine, if you cannot conform to the institution that you're working for, then you've got to move. You've got to change.
I'm just thinking, you bought ibuprofen to make it easy to buy, and millions of people suffering on a Monday or a Sunday morning must thank you. Thank you for that, for bringing ibuprofen to the wider world. I do phone in radio shows, okay? And can we just knock this gorilla in the corner, this 800-pound gorilla out of the way? Because as soon as you say pharmaceutical, people go, oh, big pharma. And it's not like chap who's got like 40 acres. There's this thing about big pharma, isn't there? What's your take on this, Graham, without using too many rude words?
I think, well, it dawned on me years ago. Every time we went to a party, I was always researching. I was asking questions. The key is to ask the right questions, obviously. And if you were introduced into a strange environment, new environment, different groups of friends and people, if you said you were in pharmaceuticals, they were all ever so well-spoken and very nice and polite and all about it. And you were sort of put in a pedestal in their minds. If you said you were in drugs, you'd be amazed the reaction you'd get.
That's Esther Poner again, isn't it, coming back to haunt you?
Yeah. Unbelievable, man. Unbelievable, yeah. So it's people's perceptions, yeah, and it's how you present and deliver it.
Mm. So you sold the company for, you know, a fair amount of money. It would have been very easy for you to sort of sit back and kick back. But you did that thing. You did two things, which one is get involved in football, which for the club you obviously love, and the second is, and I think this is the really good bit, is give back. So let's get the football out of the way first. If we can, because this is a team. It's not a it's not, you would immediately think, as a glamour team, but it's obviously a passion for you.
No, it's not a glamour team. I mean, it's a massive heart attack team, you can imagine, the last sort of 5 or 6 times. But there's millions of fans all over the world experience clubs like Huddersfield. But it was, you know, ever since I walked, I kicked a ball. So being involved, played as a kid, which was fascinating at Middlesbrough. And the other interesting thing was Brian Clough was there. So you're steeped in these classic old names that trained you. And then I always played local soccer. And then in 1989, watching a game, and the chairman overheard me passing a comment in the bar saying what a bunch of so-and-sos the directors are and what an absolute prat the chairman was. So he said, would you like to join the board, you little prat? So I said, yes, I'd love to, love to. And when I got there, the horror was the shock of the reality is they were debating. The famous end of the old Leeds Road ground was called the Cowshed.
Right.
And they were debating about the repair costs to the roof, and they couldn't raise £10,000. This is 1989. So I decided, being a buccaneer and a maverick and an absolute, you know, I always say I'm a crab, and right, I'm walking one way and everybody else is going the wrong way. You know,
yeah.
I totally believe that, you know, it's a passion. Yeah. And so I announced, forget the cow shed, we haven't got 10 grand, but we can raise 10, 15 million. Let's build a new stadium and be the first club to do so. Well, you can imagine.
But
the next 2 years, it was, shall we say, very, very difficult to get the message across. We managed to secure the full support of John Harmon, who was then leader of the council. And we built, which 30 years old next week, just before my birthday, the 4th of August. So we celebrate 30 years with new owners from America, Kevin, Jake, Dom, who are bringing the culture that was the business model 30 years ago. So I'm delighted. Yeah, fantastic.
And you didn't just put a roof on, is it? Because, I mean, it's the banana, it's the curve, hence the book. And you don't even have to follow football to go. And especially from, I mean, if it was, especially in Huddersfield, I mean, the greatest of respect to that fine town. But it was like, this was like something you expected in Barcelona. It's amazing.
Well, it's very kind of you to say so. It was extremely difficult. Even the press were against us. The players were like bamboozled because, as you know, all the fans wanted was a left back or a right back. Eventually, the chairman resigned and said, you know, oh, the hospital pass, Merry Christmas, 1992, it's all yours, and off he went. But it, you know, it is a passion. It's a love affair. And I don't care how old you are or where you are, you know, you just love the sport. The opportunity for me was to make a huge difference. I went to Toronto Sky Dome, and everybody laughed and said, what are you going to that place for? You know, this is Huddersfield. for goodness sake, you know, we've got no money. We don't have £10,000. What's the matter with you? And as I say, for 2 years, I couldn't go out in a restaurant because the fans would, like, have a go at you. So we had to dine out in Sheffield or Manchester because they wanted a left back or a goalkeeper or centre forward. And, and it's silly on me going, come on, we're building the first 25,000 and we're going to bring rugby. We're going to save the rugby club. And they're like, what? So it was exceedingly difficult. It was. But like everything, if you put the team around you, you build the right team. We chose an excellent architect in Rod Sheard, who went on to build Wembley. So, you know, and he always said if he hadn't built the Galfarm Stadium as it was then, he said he probably wouldn't have got the job at Wembley. And that's in his book of stadia. And we got a good chief exec at the time, Paul Fletcher. So you start to put a team together, which is what good manager does with a football club. Yeah.
You know,
and it worked.
You know,
it worked.
You know that Kevin Costner film, Field of Dreams? You know, the base.
Yes.
If you build it, they will come. And they think he's mad. And to say to people, Huddersfield has got a dream of getting into the Premier League, I mean, and rubbing shoulders with the big boys, again, that must have been a Kevin Costner moment. And history is littered with chairmen or people who've got involved with football clubs, and then they think they'll go and maybe start racing speedboats because it's cheaper and less stress. So therefore, but Huddersfield basically did it, didn't they? I mean, amazing.
Well, yeah, it was. I mean, the key was obviously getting the council on board. They'd been approached twice before with business plans and models. I think John Harmon absolutely adored the business model, which was to make sectors of the stadium. First of all, it was open 24/7 and not just a couple of hours on a Saturday. Secondly, it had profit centres so that it didn't, going forwards, rely on the, you know, the sort of whim of somebody coming along with mega bucks and saying they want to invest. Because that's not a secure basis for any business, and it's huge business now, as you know. But so I think with the support of the local authority, we raised the money. They secured the debt that we took on at the time, the council. And it won the first ever, I believe, was it the Architects Award for architecture in Great Britain, first football stadium, and the only one ever to have achieved it. So, yeah, it was challenging, but God, rewarding.
Talking about talking of rewarding, because we've only got 8 minutes left, believe it or not. It's quite all right. No, I mean, this is the perfect guest. We're talking about putting back. And there's, what is it, United Together and the Carers Trust? Because, again, a lot of people, the Monte Carlo Harbour is full of people who don't give back and are living pretty boring lives, to be honest with you. Oh, okay, we'll go and dine at this restaurant and I'll pick up that supermodel, which has never been a thing of yours, has it, Greg? But, you know, putting the money back into the community and something like the Carers Trust. Just explain a little bit about the philanthropy. Because, again, philanthropists get sort of thrown around a bit because people tend to do it and then have glitzy award dinners and go, look at me, and I'll give myself a prize. You're not in it for that, are you?
No, not at all. No, I can assure you, certainly not that. I don't know. I was fortunate the way I was brought up. This is a very Scottish Presbyterian way, and it was indoctrinated by love and loyalty and respect from my family and parents. I'm one of the world's worst. On Christmas Day, I hate opening presents in front of all the family. I still do today, even at my age. It's an embarrassment. So getting recognition or anything like that is embarrassing. Only because, I mean, this is perfectly true. And people listening, I think certain people will dial into this 100%. Being philanthropic and caring and sharing, the trust that we did it for and launched United Together, that was a song I wrote, and I've written loads of songs, which is the next stage of the next chapter. Volume 2 of Ahead of the Curve is in music. My music is being done. But the reason you do it is quite selfish. I remember coming out of hospital having played on Christmas Day to the children's ward in Huddersfield, card tricks, games, and entertaining them, and coming out, a couple of friends met me afterwards and they said, "Graham, that is so amazing. That is fantastic. We love it. Oh my God." And I went, "No, it's quite selfish. I actually enjoyed it more than they did." So it is quite selfish. You know, you get an amazing emotional feeling quietly that nobody else knows about or feels, just you. So therefore, I've categorized it as being quite selfish. I enjoy it.
Yeah, but I mean, I get that, but you're not the sort who's done, who then goes on Instagram saying, "Look what we're doing, you know, I'm just going to Africa, I'll grab the nearest child, take a selfie, and then get out of there." I understand that you like doing it because you enjoy it, like playing music, but at the same time, you're not running around saying, "And this is how great I am," which is the flip side, isn't it?
Yeah. No, not at all. It's not about, well, at the book launch, ironically, I came out with a phrase, "It's not about me," and the whole audience laughed because the whole book's about me, God's sake. But the event on the day was about raising awareness and money for children and adults who are physically and mentally disadvantaged, and they go to a place called Waves. So the author started a charity called Making Waves, which if you scan it in the book, you can make donations. But the incredible thing was, they heard this song, United Together, and 10 of them came along at the launch last Friday at the stadium, John Smith Stadium. And to watch over 100 people, wasn't a dry eye in the house after they'd finished singing their version of the song. It was so moving and so touching. And that cost nothing, nothing at all. It was incredible. So that's the book is all about. You know, making donations, raising funds. We're up to £15,000 already. We've just had it out a few days.
Right.
It's gone all over the world already, which is fantastic. Available on, if you go to Graham Leslie website, you can download and, is that the commercial I'm about, Charles?
Yeah, you're doing very well at that point. I'm waiting for you to come out to just pick up a guitar and do the jingle, to be honest with you there, Graham. That would be the next. When it comes to writing about yourself, is it quite difficult? Because I know you're doing it for a good cause and all the money's going to charity. So was it quite difficult to sit? And how did you write? Did you just sort of sit there with pen and paper and go, you know, on the first day I decided? Or was it dictated? Or how did you do it?
It was really, it set off to probably leave a reality check for my children and grandchildren. We've got seven children, my wife and I between us. We've got 16 grandkids. And I'm a firm believer is, you know, if they wanted to read something, then they could read it. So it took me 4 years to do all these notes. And then the local journalist, Andy Hurst, who is a very experienced journalist with the Yorkshire Post to start with and then the Huddersfield Examiner. He came and approached me and said, "I believe you've written a book." I said, "I wouldn't go that far. I've written a load of notes." And he took them away and he went through them and he said, "I think it's one of the most inspirational and passionate and buccaneering approach." It was his word, it was disruptive. I didn't like the word at first, but he's put it on the cover and said, "No, it's good because that's what you did. You didn't accept." And he said, "It's just an amazing symbol. I want to do it." So, yeah. So thanks to him. And his son was at Waves,
yeah,
who sadly passed away about 2 years ago. So he created the charity Making Waves. And so I said, "Fine, if you can do it, everything goes to your charity and I want to support that." So, yeah.
So, the book's out. You got, you know, the music. So, number two is the music. So, presumably, there'll be an album coming out the next year, Graham? Will we get the full tour? Are you going to come back and play that rooftop bar in Estepona, or will you just do the polo fields in Sotto Grande?
You've given me inspiration now. You've really jived. There's a young guy that I'm coaching at the moment called Sam Teal. He did a Christmas video 18 months ago. Amazing. Over 40 million views. And so we got together. He's done video clips of the stories, which were done in the stadium about 3 weeks ago. And then he was saying, I want to help you with doing the video clips and launches for your music. So you've inspired us. I'm going to have to ship him, give him a treat and ship him down to Malaga Airport. And I'd love to do a revival down there. Yeah, that would be amazing.
Yes, absolutely. You see, that's it. Yeah. You talked about disruptors. Well, unfortunately, you just bumped. Ask anybody who works with me. I could talk to you until literally Saturday, but I'm going to run out of time. The book is not all about me. But if people want to find you online, of course, you have the website, which is
www.grahamleslie.com.
And it's also on IE as well. I'm looking at grahamleslie.co.uk here, which is the way it is. And also, you'll be able to it's all right. You'll be able to order the book from our own virtual bookstore as well. Do you do the social media? Can people find you online on Instagram or Snapchat or anything?
No, they're about to launch it when the music comes and the videos come out, because the video pods, it's sort of talking you through the stories. We couldn't get all the stories and experiences.
Well, I'm going to run out of time and crash the news. Grahame Leslie, thank you so much for your time today.